First, are there questions? It's a little louder this time. Are there questions on last time? No. Okay. So I wanted to resume the discussion of Grover's algorithm. So let me review some of the main points and write down the algorithm. So so recall that we have an oracle and there exists, right now we're considering the case of a unique marked element x0 such that O of x0 is equal to 1. Let me rephrase that. So we're trying to find if there exists. And for the moment, assume if x0 exists, it's unique. Okay. And so then the algorithm itself is pretty straightforward. So first, we start out with the state psi 0, which is, in yesterday's terminology, u. And we do that by doing the Hadamard transform to n qubit 0 states. Next, we apply G, which is the main step here, minus 1 to the U, minus 1 to the O, M times. And so recall that minus 1 to the U was the reflection over the state U, which you can break down into H tensor N, F0, H tensor N, with F0 mapping all zeros to all zeros, and mapping anything else to minus itself. And then minus 1 to the O was the thing that used the oracle call, and it takes some arbitrary state to giving it a phase minus 1 to the oracle on that state. Okay, and this was a reflection over the state t that we had from yesterday. Okay, and so we're applying this thing m times. Remember we had this picture here where if we started with some angle theta here, applying G rotated us by started with some angle phi here, we got rotated by 2 theta, where theta and up here is x0, and this is state t. And theta is the angle between u and t. And remember that last time we calculated it, sine theta is 1 over root n. OK, and so then, so this is step 2. We do this m times for an m that we're going to figure out precisely. And then step 3 is just measure to find x0 with high probability. Okay. So this whole thing requires m oracle calls. Every time we call g, we need one oracle call to apply this minus one to the O using a phase kickback trick. And remember, this is an oracle problem, so we don't count gates other than the oracle calls. Okay? So now that I've reminded you, are there questions on it? So, okay, so let's do the analysis just a bit more carefully. So we start out with the state u, which has an angle theta with the state t. And every time we apply g, we get an additional angle of 2 theta. So after applying g k times, what's the state? We'll call that psi sub k. And it's g psi k minus 1, of course. But this analysis of the rotation tells us that it's cosine 2k plus 1 theta t plus sine 2k plus 1 theta s. Right, because we start out at the angle theta, so we have so k equals 0, we have cos theta t plus sine theta s, and every time we do k, we get another 2 theta. Okay, so this is exactly the state after k iterations. And so m should be an integer near, well, we want this to be pi over 2, this angle. So So if we want 2k plus 1 theta to be pi over 2, then we want k to be, well, we're going to specialize to the case of large n, so we don't really care about the plus 1, so theta is very small, and so k is going to be roughly pi over 4 theta, which is pi over 4 square root of n. Right, so this, and so m is an integer close to this. Well, yeah. So this k is this m. Okay, so the point is we're going to pick the closest integer to this, and that will give us not 100% probability, unless this actually is an integer, which I guess it can't be, but it will give us a very high probability, up to 1 over square root of n, basically, of getting the right answer. Okay.
Wait, sorry, why won't it give you exactly the right answer?
Oh, so because m has to be an integer, right? We're doing it an integral number of times. So it won't be the case that this thing here is exactly an integer. Okay. Because, this is irrational and this is, they're both irrational, but this is transcendental and this is not. So the product can't be an integer. So we can't get exactly to an integer, but we can get pretty close, when n is large. Okay. Okay. So, but suppose you just said, what happens if I keep on going, right? What happens if I don't stop at that point? Well, the rotation is going to continue. And what happens is you rotate from t, from close to t to very close to s, and then you keep rotating, right? And so if you go to more than this many steps, the probability of getting the right answer will start decreasing again, right? And then it'll go down and down, go to zero, and then it'll start increasing again, right? So it just goes up and down and up and down. It goes in cycles, which will be relevant in a minute. Once we start to consider the case where we haven't made this assumption. Okay, so let's do that. So, so now we're going to suppose that there are a total of t marked elements. Well, we're going to run the same algorithm, and everything's going to be the same. It's just we're going to end up picking a different m. So the only thing that's different in the analysis is we're going to let the state s be the sum over all marked elements of x. And t is then going to be the sum over the unmarked elements. And it's still the case that u is s plus t. Right, s plus t, which is the sum over everything. Okay, so with this modification, the same analysis holds, right? If we do this g, well, the reflection, this minus 1 to the u hasn't changed. That's the reflection over exactly the same thing. And minus 1 to the o is still a reflection over the state t, right? Because it gives a relative phase of minus 1 for s and for t. The s that gets the minus 1 and the t that doesn't. Okay? So we have the same analysis, except that now we have to recalculate theta. So now cosine theta, which is the inner product between t and u up to normalization. So what's the normalization? So we have 1 over n, square root of n, n minus t, because u still has big n terms, but t has now n minus t terms. And the inner product between t and u, it has, again, n minus t terms. Right, so n minus t over that gives us this. Okay, and so sine theta is 1 square root of 1 minus this squared, so it's t over n square rooted. Okay, and therefore, when we run this algorithm, we should stop when not when m is pi over 4 square root of n, but when m is pi over 4 square root of n over t. Yeah?
Now, if t is not much smaller than n, I guess you shouldn't use the small angle approximation anymore.
Sure. Okay, let me just write this down, and then we can talk about that. Yeah, so when t is very comparable to n, then you should not use that approximation. But it's still the case that you want to go about pi over 4 theta, right? And so theta is order 1, right? So this is still kind of telling you roughly the correct place to go, because n over t is also order 1. But yes, I mean, if t is a quarter theta, sorry, a quarter and then you should calculate the exact value. But the thing is that in that case, where t is a quarter n, you don't really need Grover's algorithm, right? You can actually get a speed up, like, you know, if you're searching four elements for one marked element, it turns out you can do it in I think it's, I forget whether that's one or two queries, but you can definitely do it. You know, there's like these special cases where the quantum one actually still does better, but it's small numbers, so who really cares? The interesting case is when t is much smaller than it. That's when it's hard to find classically, and you really are getting a speed up. But much smaller, I should say, doesn't necessarily mean it's, you know, it's a one or two or three. It could be that it's, you know, square root of n or fourth root of n. Right? That's still an interesting parameter range. Okay? So this is great. So if we have one marked element, we run for time pi over 4 root n. If we have two marked elements, we run pi over 4 root n over 2, and so on. But what happens if we don't know how many marked elements there are? Right? If we guess that there's, you know, two marked elements and there's actually three or four, then we're going to run for too long. And that means that the probability started to decrease again. Okay? So that's not a good thing. We need to be careful about that. Now, there are a couple of different solutions to this, but here's my favorite one. So let's make a little plot here. So this is number of iterations. So it's m. And this is success probability. So success probability is going to be somewhere between 0 and 1, sure. And we know from our analysis that it starts out, if we started, you know, at time 0 and measured right away, we would get a probability very close to 0. And then as time passes, it'll go up to something like 1, and then it'll go back down and up and down and up and down. And this is a sine wave. And the period, yeah, actually, what's the period? It's half or twice. Did I write it down? Yeah, so I guess it could be a sine squared curve. So its period is pi root n over t. So if we were to run this algorithm for lots of times, you know, if we don't know t, we run algorithms for lots of times and see what's the success probability. At each time, we plot out this curve. We could use that to find t, right? But of course, that requires running lots and lots of times to fill this out. But remember, earlier this week, we had a quantum algorithm that finds the period of functions. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to use an extra register. And so we're going to put this in, you know, a superposition of different times. And then we're going to run Grover's algorithm t times in this superposition. Okay? And that's a t, not a dagger. I guess that's not too obvious. But and I guess we're running it on the state u. Then at the end, we can calculate, well, we're not actually going to measure this, but we can, based on what this register is, we can apply the oracle to it and see if the value that we're getting here is 0 or 1. Right? Oracle value. Okay? And then, so the amplitude then of this will be periodic in t. And so we do the Fourier transform. And on the first register here, and what we get out is the period. Again, to you know, high probability. And so the number of iterations you have to run is you have to do some calculation. It depends on how precise the value of the period you want to get. Then once we know the period, and then some other stuff here. Once we know the period, then we know t. Sorry, this should not have been t. That would have been, that's confusing. Let's call this s. Run for time s. Deduce t. And then once we know t, then you just run for another pi over 4 root n over t to figure it out. Now, you won't get t exactly, like I said. You'll get t approximately. But in Grover's algorithm, that's not such a big deal, right? You don't need absolutely the probability that's maximal success. You just need to kind of get somewhere up here so that you have a reasonable chance of success of getting a marked element. Okay? And then you can try a few times to make sure that you really do get a marked element. And you should check, once you get that thing, that it really is marked. So this version of the algorithm also works then even if you don't know how many marked elements there are. So one other thing that's worth noting. So in the case where there's just one marked element, you get it fine, no question. So what happens when there's t marked elements? Which one do you get? Right? Well, so suppose you run for this time, and then you're left with to very high probability to something that's very close to the state S, which is a superposition over all the marked elements. So if you run it, you get one of the marked elements with high probability, but you don't know which one. It's a random one. Okay. When t is small, like 2 or 3, you could run it multiple times, and you're getting a random one each time. So after a few tries, you'll probably be able to get them all. When t is pretty large, like square root of n, that's obviously not viable. That would be, there's too many. Okay. But it is important sometimes that you don't really have any control over which marked element you get. You just know that you're getting a marked element.
What's the runtime of the Fourier transform again in terms of
n? The Fourier transform, so the number of qubits here is log of big N. The number of qubits here is what actually determines the runtime of the Fourier transform. Typically it's going to be something polynomial in little n, which is log of big N. But it really depends on how precisely you want to approximate the period and therefore t. And then the Fourier transform, remember, runs in time that's the square of little n. Of how many qubits there are here. It's kind of a tractable thing. Now the better question to ask, remember this is in the Oracle model. So what we actually care about is the number of Oracle calls. This doesn't involve any Oracle calls, the Fourier transform. The Oracle calls are all here. And so the number of Oracle calls is determined by the maximum time you have to run. So the maximum value of S, right, which is also related to the number of qubits here. And so that's another reason why you don't want this to run this too long. That's really the main reason, right, because you care about the Oracle calls.
Okay. So how large can S get again? What's the worst?
The worst case, you end up running it for so long that, and I think if you want to, if t could be anything and you want to nail it down precisely, you don't get any speed up over classical. And so then basically have to run for n time, I think.
Okay.
Big N time.
Because if all you're looking for is to see if there is a marked element, then why can't you just try all of the thetas? And there's about root n thetas. So it would you'd still be running it in root n.
No, but each time you try it requires root n calls.
Right. Yeah. So it's n.
Yeah. Now, I mean, there is another approach that's much simpler than this, which is just try it for some different times. And because you only need a probability that's kind of order one, you know, so if the actual answer is n over, you know, square root of n over 2, and you're doing n over 3, the probability is still going to be, you know, somewhere in the middle here. And so you have a reasonable chance of getting it. So you just kind of guess a set of possible t's, and you don't have to be too close. And you can work out that it's you're kind of get the right answer before too long. So we had two questions.
And so now, if t is not really small, but so say square root of n or something,
mm-hmm.
and you want to find all of those marked elements, then I guess what you could do is take once you find one, say, then post-process the oracle to create a new oracle, which actually outputs 0 for that element.
Sure. It's probably easier to pre-process, but yeah, sure.
Or pre-process.
Yeah, but either way.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, you can do that. The problem is that if t is square root of n, and again, you have to run this,
square root of
you know, kind of, I mean, it, well, okay. So if t is square root of n, in order to get one marked element, you only have to run like fourth root of n times. But for the last few, you're running square root of n times. And so I'm not, I guess I'd have to write it down, but I'm not sure you're going to see any speed up over just using the classical algorithm.
The implementation might be different, the right
one. Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. Someone may have looked at that. I don't know. Yeah.
So how does this work if there actually aren't any elements?
Right. Oh, yeah. Good question. So OK. So which was actually the question that we were asking originally. So what happens if there aren't any marked elements? Well, then you know, t and u are actually the same. S is doesn't exist. So when we do, in particular, when we do this minus 1 to the o, it doesn't do anything. And so we're just doing this minus 1 to the u over and over again, which is just, you know, well, the hns, if you do this twice in a row, the hns cancel. And so you're just doing f0 to some big power, which is just, you know, flipping the phase of all zeros back and forth. Doesn't do anything. And the upshot is that you end up staying in the state u all the time. And when you make a measurement at the end, you'll say, I got something. Now let me test it in the oracle, because you could always do that. And you'll say, oh, it's not marked. Now you might say, OK, I got unlucky. Right? There was a small probability of that. So let's do it again. And you'll still get an unmarked element. And you'll keep on doing it a few times, and you always get unmarked elements. And you'll say, probably this means that there was no marked element. Right? So long as you're remembering to consider that as a possibility, you can, with very high probability, decide whether it's a marked element or not. OK? Any other questions? OK, so in the homework, I have you work out, you're going to work out a couple of some of the less obvious applications, I would say, of Grover's algorithm. So I just want to, right now, give you another one, which is as a subroutine in quantum algorithms. I'm not going to give you any examples of where that comes up. But And so this is called amplitude amplification. And so the idea here is you have some quantum algorithm which creates the state, well, some state that looks like this, 1 minus epsilon psi plus root epsilon phi. And phi is the thing that you really like, but epsilon is small. So what you'd like to do is you'd like to create a state that's kind of mostly phi instead. And I guess we're assuming here that psi and phi are orthogonal. And so we want to produce phi. And I guess we should also assume that we have some measurement to distinguish these two things. Now, I mean, since they're orthogonal, obviously there exists some measurement that does that, right? But in general, it might not be an efficiently implementable measurement. So the cases we're going to be interested in is one where you can efficiently implement this measurement. So then we can apply Grover's algorithm by purifying M to some V, which basically has some ancilla, and it does V, and then you measure the ancilla. And the overall effect is to measure M. OK? And so the reason to do this is because, well, this is an ancilla, which doesn't necessarily have to be in the state 0. So now suppose you do this circuit. Yeah, I guess it is in 0 here. So the point is that this thing here, if the state is phi, then the measurement will give us 1. Right, if we just do the measurement. And so the z, so there'll be a 1 in the ancilla here, and so the z will give us a phase of minus 1. And the v dagger undoes that, and so we'll get a phase of minus 1 for phi. Whereas psi will give us a 0 down here, and therefore z doesn't give any phase, and the v dagger undoes the v, and we're left with nothing. And so this is going to be our minus 1 to the o operation. Okay, and then our minus one to the u is done with this u instead of the Hadamard, right? Because this u convert this is going to be like our state t. Sorry, our state u. And so u is the state the thing that maps us from all zeros to u. And so then, right. So the minus 1 to the u is then, I guess it's which side does the dagger have? It's u dagger f 0 u, yeah, like that.
What is the v?
V is the purification of M.
That
so this is saying this is M is a measurement. And so I could do that by doing some unitary to an ancilla and then measuring the ancilla.
Sorry, what are you trying to accomplish?
What am I trying to accomplish? Yeah. So what I want to do is so I have this measurement that distinguishes between psi and phi.
Yeah.
But what I really want to do is I want to do a phase shift on phi and not on psi.
Okay.
And so I'm using, and I know that the measurement can be efficiently implemented. So I have some circuit to do that. And so I want to take advantage of that circuit. But I don't want to actually do a measurement because this is part of Grover's algorithm, so I want to do it coherently. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to separate out kind of the interesting unitary part from the actual measurement part. And that's why I'm writing it this way.
What does V do to the ancilla exactly?
So this box here is supposed to implement M, right? So it's supposed to give the output, if I measure this ancilla, I'm supposed to get 0 if we had phi here. And sorry, psi here and 1 if we had phi here. Yeah.
So this purified measurement gives you the right probabilities, but how do you know what the relative phase, like you say it doesn't, like V doesn't affect.
Right, you don't know what the relative phase is, but we're doing V dagger here anyway, so it's going to undo that phase.
Whatever.
Yeah. So the only thing that's changed is this. So are there any questions on that? Okay, so that's the end of what I had to say about Grover's algorithm. So let's see. So far you've basically seen three pretty useful algorithms, right? There was Shor's algorithm, there was Grover's algorithm. And then in the tutorial yesterday, you worked on Hamiltonian simulation. Now there's a lot more that could be said, certainly about Hamiltonian simulation, but also about these other algorithms. One thing is that all of those algorithms date back from the 1990s. And there's been a lot of work on algorithms since then. Unfortunately, none of them have been are likely to have as much practical importance as those three. But I did want to show you one algorithm that's more recent. I guess I forgot to look up the year for it. Probably 10 years old or something by now. Maybe not quite. And this is an algorithm for solving systems of linear equations. It's known as the HHL algorithm. Oops. Broken again, yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So let's use the eraser. It was making some noises before, which was kind of suspicious. Okay. So big systems of linear equations show up all over the place in engineering and machine learning and physics and all sorts of things. And so the basic setup is this, right? You have a matrix A and a vector B, and you want to solve for X. And so of course, the way to do this is to invert A, the matrix A, right? And that can be done in a time that's polynomial in the size of A, in say the number of rows and columns. Classically using standard linear algebra techniques. The thing is that sometimes, and actually relatively frequently in the modern era, it shows up where the size of A and therefore the size of X and B are really big, right? So running at a time that's polynomial in the number of variables is still a really long time. And so there are definite circumstances where you want to be able to solve it a lot faster than that. And so the HHL algorithm is an algorithm, quantum algorithm, that solves it in a time that's polynomial in the log of the number of variables, sort of. Okay? So what it does is instead, so I mean, when you would think of this normally, you'd say, okay, I have a long list of inputs here for B and a long list of matrix elements for A. And you know, if you think of it that way, then just the time to read the input is going to be, well, the square, in fact, of the number of variables, right? So that's there's no way you could do better than that. But there's certainly lots of circumstances where it's not just given to you as a long list. So where we have some function that computes the elements of A and the entries of B. Okay? I guess maybe I should call it BI. And so once we have that, there's at least the possibility of a speedup. Except that, well, the output presumably could be the vector X. And if you had to list all the elements of X, that's again linear in the number of variables. Okay, so again, that's going to take a long time. So, so what we actually do in the quantum, so classically, you might get around this by saying, okay, I don't want to have to output all of X. I just want to have again some function that computes entries of X. Or maybe you want to compute the expectation value of X with something else. And so that's kind of where we're going in the quantum case. In the quantum case, we have input as a function. Here, this is, okay. So we have a function that computes Aij, and we have the quantum state B, which is sum over I Bii. Okay, so this big vector is now given to us as a state vector, not as a set of separate entries. Okay, and the number of qubits in this state is the log of the number of variables. And then the output will be X in a similar state vector form. Okay. And if you want to compute, say, single entries or the expectation value, well, you can do that by making a measurement on X. Okay. Where do you do this? Okay. So there's a lot of details in this algorithm, but I'm just going to give you kind of a sketchy overview of it to give you a sense of how it works. And basically, it works using techniques that we've seen before. So the basic idea. So let's assume that A is Hermitian. So if it's not Hermitian, you can still apply this algorithm. You just have to kind of work with a different matrix that is Hermitian and is related to A. And so what we're going to do is, what we'd like to do is break B down into to eigenvalues. eigenvectors of A. So uj is an eigenvector of A with eigenvalue lambda j. So why do we want to do that? Well, if B actually were an eigenvector, this would be very easy to solve, right? So if you have the equation ax equals uj, well, that implies, here, let's do it in the quantum notation. So that implies that x should be 1 over lambda j uj, right? And so therefore, when b is the sum here, the solution that we're looking for is sum over j beta j, 1 over lambda j uj. Okay? So that's what we'd like to do. We'd like to break this thing down into its different eigenvectors with some idea of what the associated eigenvalue is. So how do we do that? So the first thing is we're going to create an ancilla register, sum over tau of alpha tau tau. And so the second thing is A is Hermitian, so we're going to simulate it like a Hamiltonian. And we're going to do it for a time tau. So it's controlled by this first register. So now what do we have? We have sum over tau and j. So I'm going to expand b this way. So I simulate on this on the b register. And so we have alpha tau and beta j. And then we have e to the I lambda j tau. Okay? Because on the eigenvector uj, the time evolution of A just gives us this phase lambda j. Okay? Now let's look at this thing. So if we focus on a single j value, this is again something that's periodic in tau. Okay? And so then when we do the Fourier transform, on the first register, we're going to get, again, you know, up to issues of precision, which are a big deal. You're going to get something that looks like beta j, lambda j, uj. Okay? Yeah. Tau is the is this. So we just create a superposition over different tau values. And we're doing that because we want to run A for the time tau.
Is it representing B or X or like?
No, this is an additional register, right? So at this point we have this state and then we have B. Okay? So it's something that's very similar to what we just did here, right? We created a new register that's like our time register, and then we do something for that amount of time. Yeah?
So the times that we run it for, we pick in the beginning, right? There's some finite number of, like...
The range of times that we're going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so we assume that these eigenvalues of A are like lie within the range, right?
Yeah, that's right. So there is a big assumption here, which I was going to make explicit in a minute, that about kind of the spectrum of A. Let me finish the algorithm, then I'll write that down. Yeah.
What about the alpha tau coefficient? Is that supposed to be constant for you to actually?
No. So it turns out that I mean this is and. This is part of the details that I'm kind of going over. You don't actually want them to be totally constant. It turns out to make things work right, they vary in some way. This is a detail I definitely don't want to get into because I have 5 minutes left. Right, and but we're actually almost done, and so then I can get back to that step, and then what we want to do is we want to undo steps 2 and 3. Sorry, step 2. Oh, I left out a step. Sorry, I knew it was wrong. Okay, so step 4, we still have to get these 1/lambdas. Right. So unfortunately, unless lambda is, you know, absolute value 1, that's not something I can do exactly, even with this lambda, this register here telling me what lambda is. But I can do it probabilistically. Okay. I can do some controlled rotation, and then if I make a measurement and if I get 1, I know that I succeeded in scaling it down by lambda. And if I get 0, it didn't succeed. Probabilistic. So then when we do that, we're going to take it to beta j over lambda j. Okay. And then step 5 is we undo steps 2 and 3. To get rid of this register. And we get something like that. Okay. So what are the conditions on lambda that we need to care about? So actually, I guess you don't really need to distinguish all the lambdas perfectly, right? Because if you have two lambdas that are very close together, well, maybe this Fourier transform doesn't separate them out perfectly. But it doesn't really matter that much because 1/lambda is the same, almost, for the two of them. So that part will work OK. What does matter is if you have some big lambdas and some small lambdas, right? Because that will create a big range of times you have to do it for. And moreover, this probabilistic thing is going to be tough, right? Because actually, there could be a normalization here, right? If all of these lambdas are the same, then I haven't actually done anything, right? I just scaled everything down, but that's OK. That's the actual solution. But if some lambdas are very big, then I have to scale this down by a lot. And some lambdas are big and some lambdas are small, then I sometimes have to scale this down by a lot. And that has a very low probability of success. Okay, so what I care about is the ratio of the biggest eigenvalue to the smallest one. And this is called the condition number of a matrix. And actually, this is something that's important in classical algorithms to do this as well. Because, you know, if the condition number is very large, then that means that, kind of roughly speaking, relative to the biggest length scale in the problem, it has eigenvalues that are almost zero, right? Which means that inverting it is going to be something that's very sensitive. And so that's something that's going to be hard to do. So this is one parameter that the running time of the quantum algorithm depends on. and or its accuracy. But there's actually another parameter that the running time depends on, which is the sparsity. So why does that matter? Well, when we simulate the time evolution of A, we have to write A as a sum of terms. And then we're going to simulate those and put them together, as I think you did in the tutorial. And so to do that, it's not required that A be sparse. I mean, there's other conditions that it can satisfy that make it possible to do that in a reasonable amount of time. But sparsity is definitely one possibility. And so if A is sparse and the condition number is reasonable, then we have a good quantum algorithm. Now, the problem is, well, it's not really a problem exactly, but if A is sparse and the condition number is small, there's also classical algorithms that can approach this. And you know, they have different set of parameters, and so there are certain regimes where the quantum algorithm is still a lot better than anything classically that we know. But it's not, I think, at this point clear if there's really important practical applications that happen to sit in that regime where the quantum algorithm is a big speed up. Otherwise, this would be, you know, hugely important. As it is, it's just something that's potentially important. Okay, so are there any questions on that? Yeah.
This is about linear equations over infinite fields. Do you know if there are any results for modular arithmetic? I guess you can embed it in here, but
yeah, I'm not sure that any of this depends on that really.
I'm just saying, like, if there is like any other algorithm which could work better with finite fields, linear equations.
Sorry, classical algorithms or quantum algorithms? You mean different algorithms than this?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think this could pretty much work for finite fields as well. You might have to tweak it in a few places, but I should say that there's been follow-ups to algorithms, and there's variants and other stuff that you can do. And I mean, in recent years, there's also been a lot of work on different kinds of Hamiltonian simulation algorithms, I should say, which are improvements over kind of the simplest things that you can do. So there has been a lot of progress in kind of even the algorithms that we know about in making them better. But there hasn't been kind of any big, really blockbuster things like Shor's algorithm. Now, part of the reason for that is because we don't have quantum computers. People are also proposing, you know, heuristic algorithms where they say, well, suppose you run this, then maybe it will do better than a classical computer. But if you can't analyze it rigorously, then you need a quantum computer to try it out on. So that's something that in coming years will start to become very important. So let's end there. So this is basically all I had to say about algorithms and complexity. Next week we'll talk about some miscellaneous things, error correction, quantum key distribution, and maybe some stuff about entanglement manipulation. Okay?